Welcome to the RSP Cast. This is episode 7 of Scout Talk with Russ Landy. And Russ, you know, I want to offer you congratulations just to start off the show. Russ has been hired as a scout for the Calgary Stampeders. As you know, Russ has also been an NFL scout and also worked in the personnel department with the Montreal Alouettes. So great news for you, Russ.
Yeah, it's really exciting. You know, I mean, it sort of came somewhat out of the blue. Wasn't something I'd been expecting, but the chance to be with the team that's been in the last 12 years, they've won 3 championships, the most winning team in the last decade, and they've been the 3 of the last 4 Grey Cups. I mean, it's really an honor to be able to work for a franchise like that. And so exciting. I mean, to be working for a team with Bo Levi Mitchell as a quarterback, and is sort of he's the gold standard in the CFL, truly a special quarterback, and I'm so excited to just dive right in and try to find some players and contribute any which way I can to helping this organization win, because I'm starting out with them. I haven't been with them before, and there's a lot of people there that obviously have a lot more experience with this franchise, and I'm just hoping I can learn from them and figure out where I can contribute and help us find some football players.
Sounds excellent. Bo Levi Mitchell, I remember him at SMU, right? Wasn't he at SMU?
It's either SMU or South Carolina. I can never remember which one it is. But yeah, he's from down there, and he's been literally the last 4 or 5 years, he's been a star, superstar in the CFL. I believe he even had offers to go to the NFL a year ago, but really chose to still be the franchise man, the man that carries the team on his back up in Calgary. So I'm so excited to get to training camp and get to watch him for the first time live in terms of practice. I've seen him in games live, but I want to see what this kid looks like in practice. Give me a better idea as to how do I judge other quarterbacks, because he's the one that you compare all the other quarterbacks in the CFL to.
Sure. So speaking of which, I mean, what are some of the differences? You know, you've scouted in the NFL, you've scouted in the CFL. What are some of the differences in terms of what you're looking for, if at all, or some of the differences, you know, besides the rules of the league? You can talk about that too if you want in terms of how that impacts it. But just, you know, any differences that you've noted in terms of how your job works in those capacities?
Well, there are a handful of differences. I think one of the big ones is, and I'm sure you've dealt with it, Matt, when you talk to media and different people, is a lot of times when you talk about NFL, they talk about, oh, this scout must have fought hard for this guy and got him drafted. When in reality, in the NFL, there's so many scouts and so many directors and so many coaches that there's about 7 or 8 people that look at every player before they even get a spot on the draft board. Whereas in the CFL, the scouting departments aren't that big. So you have a real chance as a scout to get 5, 10, 15 players signed based off you finding a guy, bring him to your boss, he takes a quick look, and he says, done, and it's signed. So you get to make a much more dramatic impact as a scout. And there are really 2 philosophies in terms of when you talk about what are the differences in scouting. Because you have to have half your roster basically has to be Canadian in the CFL, and 7 of your starters of your 24, because there's 12 on each side of the ball, have to be Canadian. And when I say Canadian, I mean Canadian citizens. But the other players are all Americans. They're called internationals. And the debate is some teams go with we want to find the best player on the planet that isn't playing in the NFL. We're going to get him in. And even if a year or two down the road he leaves to go to the NFL, we're good with that. We're going to go get the best. Other teams really look at it like, hey, let's find the guys that either have been cut a few times in the NFL and aren't ever going to get that shot again, or just a shade below what the NFL looks for. And we'd rather get really good players than maybe great players, but know we're going to have them for 5, 6, 7 years if they become the player we hope they are. There's 2 different philosophies. I tend to be able, let's go get the best players possible, and if they jump to the NFL, so be it. But I think those are really the 2 different ways that people go about it. And the hard part is you have to go to NFL training camps and you evaluate the players at the bottom to try to figure out which guys might get cut, which guys might be willing to consider Canada. It really entails a lot more of digging deep, doing the nitty-gritty, because there's so many players out there, but you have to find one. You have to really narrow it down to players that are good enough to play in the CFL, are willing to come to Canada, have a passport, and don't have any baggage in their past that will keep the Canadian government from allowing them to play in Canada. So there's a lot more nitty-gritty work that goes on to get a player up there. It's almost like recruiting for college. because convincing kids that a lot of them from southern states to come all the way up to Canada, they view it as a dramatic lifestyle change, and a lot of them are very nervous about it. It's a hard sell, and that's part of the beauty, but part of the challenge of working in the CFL and scouting in the CFL.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because I'd have to imagine that there is a bit of a sales job that has to go on there. But it does kind of make me laugh as someone who does live in the South, and I think about, you know, being going up there to visit, and I think maybe from a weather standpoint, it might be a hard sell for them. But from a cultural, just opportunity standpoint, I'd imagine that once they get there, they're like, what was the big deal?
Well, you nail it right in the head. I think especially when you're in a big city like a Calgary or a Montreal or a Toronto, once they get there, they're like, oh my God, I've never heard of this city, or I've never even been to Canada. This is an amazing country. The people are incredible. There's virtually no crime. And they fall in love. But yeah, that challenge of getting a kid who maybe grew up in Louisiana, or maybe he grew up out in Oklahoma, and they've never even gone above the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
And now you're saying, hey, come to another country. And part of the other challenge is, at least in Calgary or Toronto, it's predominantly English part. But when you're over in Quebec, where there's Ottawa, Montreal, there's a real challenge with, hey, even though 85% of Quebec is bilingual, there is that sort of sense amongst Americans, and there really is a little bit of that when you go up there, is that there is a French, it's a different language. And stepping into that, even though, like I said, 85% are bilingual, there is that comfort level, and it takes a while to get comfortable. And if you are a person that doesn't deal well with not knowing everything that's going on around you and having to sort of do things on the fly, I can see it being a little nerve-wracking. I know the first time I went up there for a long stretch, and we would work during the day, but at night I was in a hotel in downtown Toronto, and I had to go get dinner and do things like that. The first few days, you're walking around trying to get your bearings, and you talk to people on the street, and they're trying to bumble through English, and you're trying to bumble through French, and there is a little bit of a challenge. So I can understand the kid that's never been exposed. I got to tell you, the opportunity in terms of, like you mentioned, culturally, it's so phenomenal. And yeah, it's a lot colder, but other than that, there's not a whole lot of difference in terms of what you see. It's a phenomenal country.
Yeah, and I certainly imagine that, especially when folks are younger. I mean, you think about, I think about something as simple as food, and you think about people who are in their early 20s, mid 20s, maybe even early, even people as old as their early 30s. And they're exposed to some sort of food that maybe for a long time they thought they hated just because they were a little kid and they had never experienced it. And the idea of it just viscerally was challenging to them. And then you even have to break down a barrier of them being an adult and saying, hey, you know, actually raw fish is pretty good, you know? And, you know, and when they have it for the first time, they realize, oh wow, this is totally different than what I expected. But I would have to imagine it's the same thing when you come to a country and you see different languages posted in public in a way that you have to learn a little bit of it to be able to navigate. And that can be very intimidating. So I can understand, even coming from that kind of making that leap from, you know, the little kid who thinks he doesn't like fish, you know, to realizing he's the adult who actually loves it. You know,
well, I'll give you just a good story from my last year with the Alouettes. We brought a player up, and he's from a small town in Oklahoma. We get him up there, and his first night there, we spent the day with him. We brought him to the hotel, and he's like, what should I do for dinner? We said, well, here's some per diem, basically, and you can wander around. He said, well, is there a place you'd recommend? And I said, go check out this place. Their poutine is great. He's like, what's poutine? And we told him it's basically a plate of French fries with different sauces on it. And he goes, sounds okay. He goes, I'll give it a shot. He loved it. And a week later, when he went back to the States and we were chatting, I was like, so what did you think? Did you enjoy sampling the food? He goes, well, because I can't say I sampled it. He goes, after I went to that place the first time, he goes, I pretty much ate every meal at that place because I just got different flavored poutine every time I went there because they had like 35 different types. And he fell in love with poutine. So, I mean, it really is. It's something that I think is great for these young kids. Even if they only play a year or two in the CFL, just like you and I have had the opportunity to travel, a lot of kids at 21, 22, like myself, didn't have that chance at that young an age. So just to get the chance to go to another country, see how other people live and experience that. I think it's so valuable. And I think a lot of these kids do it. And they're like, wow, you know, traveling's not so scary. And now I can start going on trips to other countries and doing things like that because I don't have that fear now of getting on a plane and going through another country and going through customs. It doesn't scare them like it does a lot of young people, like I know it did me when I was that age.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, you know, we're going to be traveling pretty soon because we have the All-Star Game circuit coming up. You know, the Shrine Bowl is, you know, practices are next week. And then in a couple of weeks, the Senior Bowl practices start up in Mobile. So with that in mind, and what are your thoughts? Or I thought what would be kind of open up for discussion is our thoughts about how the All-Star practices and games, how that can change people's outlook in terms of how they view these players, both from a positive standpoint and also from a standpoint that might be dysfunctional or destructive for your overall evaluation.
You know, it's really one of the things that isn't talked about enough is that the Senior Bowl or the East West or whatever game it is, it has enormous value, but you have to put that value in context. You can't say their performance over 3 days of practice in one game in Mobile is equal to their whole senior season and really their whole college career in terms of weighing it on scale. Yes, it's important to see how they function when they're not the big fish in a small pond, when they're a little bit uncomfortable, when they're having to learn a very basic scheme to be able to get out there and practice, when they have to interview at night and really get pulled in 8 million directions when they're off the field. It's valuable, but at the same time, you can't put so much value on it that you forget about everything they did on the field. And part of the reason I talk about that, I think it's so valuable, is some of the best players I ever saw in Mobile in terms of the best performance while they were in Mobile were Alphonso Smith, a small corner out of Wake Forest, Andre Caldwell, a receiver out of Florida, and Jay Cutler, the quarterback out of Vanderbilt. They had some of the best 3 days of practice I've ever seen any player have. And none of them, I mean, Cutler started for many years, but I don't think anybody would ever say he was an elite player. And Caldwell and Smith really just became guys. Barely even got on the field after a while. And on the other end of the spectrum, guys that were terrible there, guys like Richard Sherman, Chris Johnson, I mean, guys that really struggled when they got there, it tells you that, yes, it's valuable. And the interview part and seeing all the different aspects of what goes on there, but you have to take it with a grain of salt. You don't want to start saying, yep, you know what, we have a first-round grade on this kid, but he got burned a few times and he got beat in one-on-ones. It's like, take a deep breath. Just remember what you're looking at. And to me, the All-Star games are a great chance to just compare position groups. Okay, here's the seven tight ends. Okay, who's the best athlete when I watch them run around? Who catches the ball the best? And at least have something where you can start to separate some of the guys, but you can't let that change your grade. And I think it's one of the things that I think young scouts sometimes, they'll go to these games and they'll see a player and they'll fall in love and they'll almost disregard all the hard work they put in leading up to that. And basically change their grade or set their grade based on what they saw in practice for 3 days. So I think the All-Star games are immensely valuable, but you have to be so cautious not to let it completely disrupt the influence and influence what your grade was based on actual film, which if anybody, man, you're the guy who lives and breathes and sort of climbs inside the film projector to grade players. And you'd hate to say, okay, I did 9 games of film on Joe Burrow. Then I go to Mobile and he has a shoddy day or two, and all of a sudden I'm going to throw out those 9 games where he looked like a freak of nature. But that happens because it's human psyche. When you see something live and in person, sometimes that can outweigh all the little stuff you've done watching film. And I think that's why All-Star games, like I said, very valuable, but you have to be so cautious.
Yeah, and it's also – you also go from a situation where you're alone studying and you have your own process – to where if you're a young scout, you may be interacting with a number of people that you haven't interacted with before. Some of them who may be older than you, have more experience than you, who may have been doing this job on a level in a different way than you have. And you may not be familiar with their process, with how they look at things, how they value it. Some of it may be extremely valuable and things that you need to know, but some of it might, you might not understand the full context of what they're looking at. And you can end up, you know, if you're young and impressionable, you can wind up, you know, taking looking at all of this and giving too much weight to outside opinions that you hear, and then going back and watching tape to and trying to apply something that you don't really understand, and end up inflating or deflating the player's value. Because, and then the way I say that is that you have to have some level of a compass, when an internal compass, when you're a scout, of basically saying, this is how I go about doing things. And if there's something that challenges that, fine, but I need to understand the context very clearly of how it challenges it and how I would change my process possibly if this proves right or wrong. And it's, and it isn't likely going to be the basis of one player. It's probably going to be, you know, several players at that position. And when you look at, you know, the one player may spark that thought, you know, maybe Joe Burrow, maybe the way he releases the football or the way he uses his feet is something different than what you normally would look at for quarterbacks. And it's slightly different. You normally would have graded down for him in a certain area. And you overhear, you interact with some people who are pointing out that they see that as a positive, or see it as at least a neutral thing that's a non-factor, that you're weighing as a negative factor. And then, you know, you may ultimately change your mind about Burrow, but at the same time, you want to have that understanding of your process to look at it and say, is this going to change how I look at quarterbacks, not just a quarterback? And then looking at, you know, and then there's just what people keep up with what the media says and what you look at. I mean, I think about, you know, it's hard not to pay attention to the idea that, oh, Andy Isabella's having a great practice last year, and people thinking that, and you can get caught up in one year to the next of who's the top guy and who's having a great practice, and not really understand the context of it, and maybe not even look back at past practices. Because I look at a guy like Isabella who you know, had one big play this year and for the most part didn't start. And I remember people were just gushing over him because of what he did as a route runner. And, you know, I've been through that before, watching Braxton Miller do some of the same exact things that Andy Isabella did. And what they did was they ran what I call playground routes, which are, you know, they have lots of moves. They're extremely quick, really athletic. But when you watch them in the context of, hey, that looks good in practice, and they're making people look foolish in practice, but in the game, is that route really going to work? Is it really efficient enough for you to be able to be where you're supposed to be? And when someone puts a hand on you, what do you do then? And the answer was, they don't do very much. And you look at Braxton Miller's career, how that's turned out and how what he struggled with. And then you look at Andy Isabella and go, it's the same thing. But meanwhile, you're listening to like two out of every three people, you know, who are in the media and who you might be interacting with are like, who do you think's having a good practice? Oh, Andy Isabella's ripping it up. You know, you look on TV, Andy Isabella's ripping it up. Yeah. And you have to understand that part of it too is those psychological factors that you like to say, hey, you know, I'm not prone to peer pressure. I'm going to stick to what I see. And everyone loves to say that when they walk into a public environment. But it's different when they're actually there, and you actually have to learn to kind of make yourself a little bit immune to that, or understand how to put a filter on it at a level where you're not being stubborn and you're open to learning, but at the same time, you balance it out with, these are the things I'm going to be firm on. And if I'm wrong, that's okay, because I can incrementally make adjustments based on, you know, on knowing where I want to go, rather than just being going from one whim to the next and then never really being in a direction, and you're never going to have a set direction of where you're heading. Your development's never going to move forward as a scout if you're just basically going, well, who's popular now? Who does everybody like now? Because half the people will be wrong. And then you're like, well, great, I thought I was heading in the right direction here, but now next year you're talking something completely different. And if you looked at it in that context, you realize that, wow, I'm moving east to west from one year to the next and never have a center.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I'm sure this probably developed over the years of you doing your publication is when you first start scouting, it really is everybody's belief is I'm gonna do such a good job that I'm gonna be right on everybody. And after a while, it takes you 3, 4, 5 years to start realizing, you know what? No matter how much work I do, you're gonna miss on probably 30%. Just the way it is. You're just no matter what you do, you're going to be wrong. And I think sometimes you have to say, you know what? I have my, and you mentioned it perfectly. You have to develop your process. Once you've developed your way of being able to do things that's efficient and effective for you, you have to – yes, obviously, you'd both be foolish to say you never change, you never adjust. But you want to develop a system that works for you. You can tweak it and adjust it when needed. But you don't want to be willy-nilly because once you've developed something that has been successful in general, then when you see something as an outlier, it's not going to get you all excited, either positively or negatively, to change your whole process. Because once you've gotten comfortable with the fact that you're going to miss, it's going to happen, but you have your sort of your foundational way of working and doing things, you're going to be more comfortable sort of pushing the noise away and saying, yeah, I know Isabella looks great during these 3 days of practice when he's beating guys in one-on-ones, which is probably the offense has such an advantage running those one-on-ones that it's sort of easy. It's almost like a cakewalk for anybody that is athletic and quick and has a little bit of burst. Well, they're going to look great. But when I saw him on film, I didn't see these same traits. And that's where having that process, having something you can say, you know what? Yep, this looks great here. But what I've seen on film, I feel more comfortable putting my stock in everything, all the work I've done. And it really, the point that you make about figuring out your process, everybody has a different way of scouting. You have to figure that out. It takes time. And I don't mean it takes time like an hour or two. I mean it takes time like 3 or 4 years of watching film and working out the kinks and getting rid of things that are important to you and bringing in new things that are important to you to find what works. Those, having that foundation allows you to be successful at these All-Star games of not overvaluing certain things, not letting the buzz get in your head, and just keep doing your work, keep identifying the traits that help you best determine a player's success or failure rate in the NFL.
Well, let's talk about some of these positional drills then, or things that we see on the field. And I'd love to hear from you what you value, say, from observing a practice for specific positions. I mean, like let's start with the trenches. What are things that you look for, either on the offensive line or defensive line, from these practices that you value highly, and or maybe something that you look at and say, here, I take this a little bit more with a grain of salt.
Well, you know, I mean, everybody loves the one-on-one drills, and I think they're very valuable in certain respects, but just like receivers have a huge advantage in the one-on-ones, defensive linemen have an enormous advantage when they're going one-on-one with the O-line. Because the O-line's not structured that way. They're structured to know where their help is and how they can do things. And when it's one-on-one, they're sort of dead. But what I love about the one-on-one is you do get to glance, especially for the offensive linemen, at their ability to bend. And you get the most important part is when they get beat, how do they react? Does it start to get them to go down that tunnel where they start to drop their head and they feel like they're beaten and they start making more mistakes? Or does it not even faze them? Do they jump right back and they're ready for the next rep? To me, that's something I want to see. It's not so much about winning or losing. It's how do they mentally process it. I also like to see the drill where they have the linemen line up with an outside shaded defensive end where he has to get to him and try to keep him inside, pinned inside. Mm. I find that to be a real valuable one for both sides. For the offensive lineman, I want to see what is his footwork and can he bend and turn without having to lean and reach? Because a lot of guys are so stiff they can't. And when you get that guy who can actually drop his hips and turn that guy, it tells you, wow, this guy really knows what's going on and how to do it. And when I see the defensive lineman who can get out there and know what they're doing, because a lot of college defensive ends, everything they've done has been clear, just all athleticism. And boom, all of a sudden, you see a guy that knows what he's doing, correct shoulder, correct footwork, uses his hands the right way. Those guys get me excited because even though they may not have the potential that a better athlete does, at least I know or have a pretty good feel that this guy fundamentally is going to be a lot more further along when he comes in as a rookie. And when I'm in day 3 of the draft, yeah, it's great to say I want to take a guy who I think can become a starter, but you really got to start saying, hey, I got to find a guy who I think can contribute. And a guy that's fundamentally sound, knows what he's doing, has a better chance of being able to be your third or fourth defensive end earlier in his career than a guy who may be a freak athlete but has no clue what he's doing. So those are two drills in particular I really pay attention to. I find you can get more from the lineman than almost any other position when you're down there in Mobile.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand that. And it's funny because when you talk about the line, I can certainly see – I've often looked at defensive ends and pass rushers and like to use some of the techniques that they use and see that as a bridge for what wide receivers have to do to release off the line of scrimmage. Yeah. So for me, you know, it's valuable to watch some of the one-on-one drills where they have the defenders playing press man. You know, off coverage – off man coverage, you know, there's some things that can work with that. And but really, when you can play press man and you get to see these receivers, especially when they have the teams use the drills where they put a 5-yard restriction of width in terms of where the receiver can go, or tighten it even more and say, listen, you can't go outside these cones, and we're going to give you this small alley for you to get separation. Then you really get a chance to see who understands how to avoid press coverage and how to work through it. And do they have a variety of moves in their repertoire? Can they combine them in different ways? Can they play the man and understand what the defender's trying to do and actually create solutions that maybe they weren't using, you know, that they can combine solutions in different ways? Can they use a 3-step and use a chop? Can they use a rip move with a different type of footwork combination, you know, or are they just using the same thing all the time? And do they get frustrated when they get shut down, you know, and how do they handle that as well? So to me, there's, you know, that's one of the great ones, as well as just, like you said, seeing physically how they bend, you know, some of the drills that they have where you have 4 cones and they basically work in a rectangle and and you're seeing how well that they can bend and turn a corner, how well they're moving their feet in terms of being able to point those toes and open their hips and be able to make the short turns. Can they accelerate through it? Because you want to see how much they've worked on these particular skills, because some of the things, based on their body type, they might be too stiff to be able to ever really be able to develop into that kind of a route runner on certain routes where you're going to have those types of inside and outside breaks, or breaks back to the quarterback where you're going to be super fluid. But there's a lot of guys where they're physically capable of doing it, but you can tell that they haven't really worked on it to the level where they're proficient with it. So part of it too is seeing, have they improved over the course of the week, maybe with some basic fundamentals where maybe a coach says, hey, listen, drag your toes at the end of the boundary here, or here's how you want to, you know, point your toe and open your hips to do this, and see if the next day or two or three that he shows some progress doing it. And it's not linear. You're not looking for, you know, day two, suddenly he's pointing his toe more and now he's getting a sharper break and now he's got to bring the second foot around. And now day three, let's see if he brings that second foot around. No, it's more like he may do it perfectly day two for a rep or two and then just, you know, not be able to do it for the rest of the hour. And then day three doesn't do it at all. And day four, he shows it again. And you're like, okay, I saw enough that tells me he can make some progress if he works at this. You know,
it's
going to be incumbent upon him, but but the potential is there. So for me, those are worthwhile.
You know, the one thing I wanted to mention, because you mentioned the one-on-ones, the one thing I think is so interesting is I remember when I started going to the Senior Bowl back with the Rams and Browns, I still remember that because they do, and you've been down there so much, you've seen it too, is when they do the one-on-ones, it's not just the corners. The safeties get thrown in there too with the receivers.
Yeah.
And 15 years ago, they would literally put 225 and 235 pound strong safeties out there with these 5'9 little receivers, and it was always like, oh, what a waste of time. Right. Nowadays, although obviously the safeties are a mismatch, it is a good opportunity to see, because in today's NFL, safeties are going to get mismatched into covering receivers. And every once in a while, you'll be down there and you'll see a safety who actually holds his own. It may not be great, and he may get beat, but you can see that, wow, he's got better hips. He's got some of the traits of a corner, And it makes you think, oh, this guy's a safety that's going to be able to really be valuable in coverage as opposed to a guy that's just going to basically get by and avoid trying to get beaten badly. This guy can actually make plays and be a positive part of coverage. And it's one of the things I think that's evolved over the last 15 years is the value of that safety who can actually help in coverage in man-to-man, whereas 15 years ago, it's a waste of time. They would have these giant gorillas trying to cover these little munchkins, and it just wasn't even worth watching.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. You know, one thing that comes to mind to me is, say a wide receiver who's just, he's catching the daylights out of the ball in practice, like doesn't drop a single catch. And, you know, technically he's sound, he's, you know, and that's really the connection, because there's a lot of guys who don't drop a ball in practice and technically they're not very sound. Like, yep, they have good hand-eye coordination, but the way they frame the ball is awful. I mean, like, you know, a guy that comes to mind to me is like Ted Ginn has trouble framing the football. Yep, and he's, and he's like, he's a day one athlete. He's had a long career because you can use him in a specific role. And as long as he fits within that role within your offense, he can be productive for you and help other players out because of his threat as a speedster and an after catch guy. And while he will make some contested plays with that god awful framing of his hands, he's a guy that in practice you could see how he might catch everything, and then you could still justify why he drops one or two passes every other week as a result of the bad hand framing. But what about guys who they have the good technique, or it's good enough, and there's maybe the issues aren't major, and they're catching the daylights on everything in practice, but when you're watching them on tape, they're dropping stuff. They're not able to make those types of plays that they're making in practice. How do you kind of work through that?
Well, a lot of that really comes back to you going back and almost pulling the film and saying, okay, getting the clips of, okay, where are the drops? Okay, the drops are on these, say, four routes in particular, and then pulling every one of those routes that they've run, both when they caught it and dropped it, trying to figure out what is it. Is it a problem with this technique that you're not noticing? Is it awareness? There are so many little things it can be. But one of the things I remember finding out was there was a kid a while back who in games, in full uniform in the whole nine yards, struggled with consistency, really struggled, battled the ball. At practice, both when I visited the school and at the All-Star game, wasn't the Senior Bowl, I think it was East-West or a different game, caught the ball really well. And what I found out was, in games, because of the contact, he didn't like to wear the big sort of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar goggles. Uh-huh. So he tried to go with contacts. And for whatever reason, it just screwed up his vision. Even though contact should be technically the same thing, it just didn't work as well. Yet when he would be in practice, he would just stick on the goggles because other time throughout the day, he didn't need them. And practice is only certain periods, so he just pulled them on and off, caught the ball much better. Now, I'm not saying it's always glasses, but there's often, you can, if you do your research, you can find out if it's his unwillingness to focus and pay attention to detail in games because so many other things are going on and his emotions are high, or it's that he only does well when he's in a practice setting because he gets to think between each rep and he gets to remind himself to make sure he uses good technique, stay focused on the ball, all those little things. Whereas when it's in a game, you're literally one player after another. You don't get a lot of time to clue yourself off and say, okay, let's make sure when I go to catch the ball, I keep my hands like this and catch the ball like this. So sometimes just that break in practice can be enough for them to reset and stay focused and catch the ball better. Where in a game, you don't get that break. So it's really important to go look at the film and try to figure out where is that lapse? What is the difference between the drops I see on film and the drops I don't see in practice, whether it's at an All-Star game or even at practice at the school? Because if you don't figure that out, good chance you're going to bring a kid into your building that's going to struggle catching the ball.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it also speaks to guys who really need, you know, they need a lot of practice to be good in the game. And that practice is more on in the game. They have to be given opportunities that are very close to practice, which means that there's only going to be a select number of plays you can use them on because exactly. They have to be heavily scripted as opposed to free flowing type of work. And I think a good example of that was Cordero Patterson. He was a guy that I remember I made the mistake on because I loved so much of his physical skills and what he did, you know, at Tennessee, but you know, soon learned that what he was that kind of, you need to prep him. He needs a lot of work to learn what you want him to do, but it has to be highly structured on the field in the game for him to get to make the most out of it. And that meant that he only was available for a select number of plays, which is interesting because you see, you know, someone like Bill Belichick, who's so great as a coach, but at the same time you hear him in the media say, we're going to make Cordero Patterson the player that he was meant to be. And I'm thinking, I wonder how much he watched Cordero Patterson in practice. And we had Cordero Patterson and he did a good job with Patterson, you know, using him the way he did, but he was only in New England for a year.
Exactly. You know, and it's one of those things where when you look at certain guys and it's not just receivers, it's a lot of different positions where the mental is a challenge. In practice, sometimes that doesn't stand out as much. Whereas in games, you can see the smoke coming out of their ears sometimes when they have to adjust, or you'll see that situation sometimes where a defender, the whole defense shifts and he sort of stands there like, doesn't move, doesn't do anything. And when the ball snapped, he's sort of standing there for a second. And he just doesn't seem to grasp what's going on. When a guy can't grasp it in games, and that doesn't mean they can't be successful. It means you have to figure out how do you make them successful. That's the job of a coach. But like you talk about with the receiver, Cordell Patterson may be the greatest example of that for a receiver because at Tennessee, he was a dominant player. Okay. They had figured out what he could do, what he couldn't, and they limited him to only doing pretty much what he was able to do. And that's great in college. You can't get away with that in the NFL because if you are that limited, teams will literally eliminate you from the game plan defensively because they'll understand what you can and can't do.
Yeah, probably one of the top 3 to 5 open field runners I've seen that were in my lifetime. You know, not
a freak of nature runner. Unbelievable how good he was at Tennessee.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, a good way of putting that, I think, for someone just listening too, is go play chess, you know, or play cards, but use a timer. Like, do it without a timer and with a timer. And the people there are people you know who you play against who, if you give them lots of time to think through everything, you can't beat them. But if you put them on a timer and they have to do it within a certain period of time and the game's fast paced, they self-destruct. They're not half the player that they were, you know, in that type of environment. It's the same thing with football, you know, and I think that, you know, that maybe the value of quick practices and quick tempo practices also help out in seeing a hint of that a little bit, but still 100%. But it's not, you know, for the game. And it's funny what you talk about in terms of going back to watch the tape and trying to figure out how things are, because this just came to mind because I want to talk a lot about quarterbacks, you know, and kind of wrap this segment up with the quarterback part, because, you know, I've probably watched 8 or 9 games of Tua Tagovailoa, and I watched about 4 of them probably over the past weekend. And I just put out like an hour-long analysis of him on my YouTube channel, just breaking down aspects of his game that are positive, things that he may need to work on depending on the environment that he's getting in, and the things he definitely needs to improve upon. But one of the things that's interesting is I overheard or saw something on Twitter last night as I was putting this out that people were – or before I put this out that people were talking about that some people worry about him, you know, taking too much time in the pocket. And it was funny because I'm looking at this and watching him play and realize that it may not, you know, for quarterbacks, sometimes it's not so much about how much time they take in terms of whether their clock is off, but how much awareness they have peripherally about space, like how much space they have. And knowing how much space they have may dictate how much time they think they have.
100%.
So it's not so much about whether the clock goes off at the right time, but really about because the clock's more dictated by what's going on, the motion around them. And I think I look at Tua and I realize that the clock's just fine, but he's a guy that when you watch, you know, when you overhear something like that, you watch it and you look at the clock, you realize it's more about his awareness of space, where when he feels like he has enough space, he's going to take that time, but he doesn't always gauge the space well enough around him.
Yep. And I will say, when I looked at him, the thing that I was surprised at, and I don't know if you saw this, because I had not looked at him, and I had heard so many people talk about him being a guy that was sort of an old-fashioned drop-back quarterback who couldn't avoid the rush, who held on to the ball and had a long release and long decision-making process. And when I watched film, I was like, you know what? I was like, I let that get in my head too much, because when I watch this kid, when he does get pressured, he's able to move, reset, and get rid of the ball quicker than I probably went into it thinking he could, because I'd heard so many people talk about him being sort of that old-style, traditional pocket passer. And there's a lot of things to like about him. When I watched him, I was stunned at how well he did some of the things I didn't think he'd be able to do well.
Yeah, I agree. I think he has, when it works well for him, he can really abbreviate or truncate his release under pressure and do it in a way that he can just flick that ball. Now, it's not always successful in certain situations, because he's a guy that I think that when you force him off his spot to like throw off his back foot or to throw jump passes, that he kind of does the things that both positive and negative that Jimmy Garoppolo does, where it's kind of like you're turning your body away from the defender in mid motion and you're kind of, you know, hurting your accuracy a little bit. But at the same time, there are plays where he can, you know, if the receiver's in a situation where it's not tight coverage, he can flick that ball out and give a receiver a shot on a play that a lot of quarterbacks can't. And if he has his feet under him and he can deliver in rhythm and avoid plays or avoid defenders in rhythm, reset and fire in rhythm with his feet under him, he's very good. And I think that his release is quick enough that especially with how he can truncate it and alter it on certain things, that, yeah, I think there's a lot of good with him. And you combine that with how precise he is and how he can turn and move and set up, open up in certain directions. He really forces you to cover the whole field.
So Russ had to leave a little bit early for this show. We're not going to be doing our players that we have that have caught our eye while we're doing our scouting for the 2020 NFL draft. Instead, I'm going to go to the mailbag and I'm going to answer some questions that I've gotten from Rookie Scouting Portfolio subscribers. And for those of you who haven't subscribed to the RSP yet and you've just gotten into this podcast and you like it, well, thank you very much for listening. And I would recommend for you to really check out the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. It's the best work that I do. This is what you get for $21.95, just one price. You get a pre-draft and post-draft publication and a newsletter that comes out monthly from June through December that provides updates on the past 3 years' worth of rookie classes. So I give you rankings updates three times during the year, usually in May with the post-draft, and then twice during the year in the newsletter. The pre-draft publication, it's available for download April 1st. I've been doing that, and that's the date. I've been doing it since 2006. You get detailed player profiles of at least 150 skill position prospects for the offense, and it goes really deep. We're talking about quarterbacks, running backs, wide receivers, and tight ends, and I even go into position sub roles, so it's not just running back, but also guys who are more satellite space backs or slot receivers in addition to just receivers. The rankings have tiers, so you're not just looking at, oh, he's fifth on my board. Does that mean he's, you know, how close is that to number one? Well, with tiers, you get a chance to see really where these guys belong in relation to one another. And then I give you my analysis on players that I think are overrated, underrated, who I think has developmental potential. And each chapter for these positions are dedicated to, you know, the draft history on these players, as well as taking you through my entire process where everything's defined in writing in terms of how I grade. And you can really just look up the glossary that I have of defined criteria used to grade players. If you had the time, you could literally do your own grading and use this process. It's all laid out for you like that. It's just whether you're that kind of crazy like I am. And then the post-draft publication, you get depth chart analysis and commentary, team fit, contract-related outlooks, trade market analysis for fantasy leagues, rankings for fantasy rookie drafts, including overall rankings, position rankings, and tier groupings, and you even get draft selection data for your dynasty league. So I look at the early average draft position data, and then I create a formula that compares what I think their value is related to what the ADP data is, and help you determine a sweet spot for where you can get these players at a projected value based on my rankings, but not reach too early for them, but still guarantee that you're going to grab them in most situations. And then, of course, the updated combined rankings for the 2018 through 2020 classes and undrafted free agents to watch. So you get the pre-draft, the post-draft, and the newsletter for $21.95, and a percentage of the money is donated to Darkness to Light, which is a fantastic organization dedicated to preventing sexual abuse in communities of sexual abuse of children. So what they do is they educate, little leagues, municipal organizations, any type of group that works with children, and and talk to them about how to spot predatory behavior and grooming behavior, how to address these situations if unfortunately they happen, and they do, and being able to make it a situation where you don't wind up hurting the child more, because oftentimes these situations, as unfortunate as they are, people don't know how to address them, and it can actually cause as much or more trauma to the child as the actual abuse. So Darkness to Light, fantastic organization. I've been giving to them since, I believe, 2011 or 2012. A percentage each year goes towards that. So thank you again for those of you who get the RSP. It is available right now for you to pre-order a login, and then you can download it when it's available. And I'll always let people know when it's available, every April 1st. And then the post-draft is available 1 week after the NFL draft, or at least no later than 1 week after that. So let's get to our mailbag. I appreciate you guys hanging in there with my little advertisement there. I know it's not a 2 minute thing, but considering I don't advertise all that much, you're going to get a little bit of a more detail with it. So Ben wrote me, and he asked me a couple of things that I thought were, important. And one of the things he said is, I saw your video on DJ Dallas that you put up recently on YouTube. DJ Dallas is a running back out of Miami, and it seems like he's at least an enthusiastic blocker. And that's something I noted, that he is definitely willing. And I talked about this in this video, that he's an all or nothing pass protector. He said, in limited tape I could find of him from last year, he seemed just as willing of a blocker, but sat in the quarterback's lap a little bit more, had less success blocking. Would you say that better blocking technique is something an enthusiastic blocker can learn? Or like a linebacker taking an offensive lineman with his shoulders instead of stacking and shedding, is it pretty thoroughly ingrained? Now, to me, I think it's definitely something that a player can learn. A running back can learn to use his hands better as a blocker. And it's just a matter of how much he wants to learn how to do that. If he's willing to actually deliver shots on larger defenders and do it consistently like Dallas does, then I think that points to that his behavior in terms of the willingness will definitely translate to his willingness to want to use his hands. If he'll be able to learn it. It's just a matter of whether he wants to. So one of the things that I mentioned is Ben favors people who throw themselves into non-glamorous aspects of the craft. And what do I think about that? And I just have to point out that I think we always have to remind ourselves that these prospects are young men and they're still learning the game. I mean, again, most of their coaching happened in Pop Warner middle school and high school. And there's a lot of competing demands that you have. One is, as a kid in Pop Warner, your competing demands are whether you're chasing butterflies or chasing the ice cream truck. In middle school, you're dealing with probably other outside activities that you may have to do, as well as the things that are going on in terms of your own personal life, where it's still a mix of you somewhat chasing butterflies, so that may also be extended to chasing girls, and then when it comes to high school, you also have competing demands in terms of other clubs, academics, and a limited amount of time, maybe a part-time job. So you're not going to be able to devote your time to the craft of football as if it's a job for you in most cases. So you have to understand that even the guys who are at the highest levels aren't necessarily able to put in that kind of time either until they get to the pros. So if they show that they're enthusiastic about doing a certain aspect of the job, it's a good sign that they'll become enthusiastic to learn more about the craft. But we're not going to know that. And we're not going to know whether he's a smart worker who's going to seek the best instruction or he's going to self-scout to develop his craft the right way unless you're there to learn more about him during a player interview. So to me, I would put a player like Dallas's blocking in the middle spectrum of his peers, you know, giving him a small bonus for the potential that he is physical, that he's willing to take on guys and that he's had success, you know, from the physical aspect of the game as a blocker. He just has to learn the technique. And if he can prove that he can do that and start doing that, then he's going to develop to a top end guy. And the second question that Ben had related to CD Lamb, and I thought this was a great one. He's like, listen, CD Lamb's getting a lot of love right now. A few analysts have him as the best wide receiver in this class. However, when I watch him, I've seen that a great deal of his long plays are contested catches. It never seems easy unless there's a busted coverage. Defenders seem to stick with him the whole time, safety or corner. I don't know enough about wide receiver route technique to really know what the issue is, but it seems like he doesn't get open on deep routes. I love what he can get, that he can get contested catches, but it worries me that I haven't found tape of him flustering lesser competition with his route running the way, say, T. Higgins or Justin Jefferson does. I still have a lot to learn about wide receiver play, but this seems like a concern. Do you have any thoughts that you could share? And, you know, I have to go back and look at my CD Lamb notes, and I've probably done that before I did this podcast. I probably should have done that. But I remember, you know, seeing how much speed that he does have in the open field. So one of the things that I mentioned to Ben is that I think, and if you're listening now and you haven't read your email yet, then great. Your contrasting of Higgins and Jefferson, I think, provides a clue of the difference between those two guys and Lamb. And what I would probably go back and do first is watch how many of the targets Lamb's receiver or targets that Lamb's quarterback throws before Lamb is making his break. In essence, how good is Jalen Hurd's anticipation? Because often a quick, fast receiver who faces a lot of contested targets, oftentimes they're doing so because the quarterback isn't delivering the ball with the proper anticipation for the route and the ball arrives late, which when, as you start to look on the broadcast tape, you'll see that the defenders are pretty much recovered and are right there because the receiver has to wait on the ball. So there's possibility that that could be the situation. Another possibility is to see whether Jalen Hurts is delivering pinpoint passes for that route. You know, so before even going to the routes, I'd consider if the quarterback delivers with anticipation and placement first. And if that checks out, then I'd consider the designs of the routes and whether those routes are naturally involving contested situations a little more often and how often these routes are run versus man or versus zone coverage. Because again, if you're targeting a guy in zone coverage, it's more likely that the receiver is running into an area where it's already going to, there's already going to be a defender there. So he's running into a contested situation and he's forced to have to do that because it's the quarterback's targeting him into a smaller opening in zone. Whereas if it's man, you know, if he's getting, you know, he's facing tight man coverage, well, you know, then you're looking at whether or not the quarterback's throwing the ball at the top of the receiver's stem right before his break and delivering the ball then, or he's waiting for the receiver to break open. Because if he's waiting for the receiver to break open, that usually gives the cornerback an opportunity to turn and run. And cornerbacks are usually the fastest guys on the football field. And, you know, if they get to run and chase as opposed to, you know, work in a backpedal, they're going to be able to make up speed pretty quickly. So I hope that helps. The last question is from Dan Kay. And Dan asked me what my thoughts were on Devin Singletary's season. You know, he saw my review on Singletary and felt like that I had wanted to see Singletary prove what he could do on an NFL field after looking at his combine metrics and looking at his tape from college. And how have I felt? Has anything changed based on what I've seen? And I think that, you know, it's a great question. I'm glad that I got asked this, is that, you know, at first when I started watching Singletary over maybe the first 6 to 8 weeks, what I mostly saw was a terrific Bills offensive line. And I don't mean that to slight Singletary. It was just that the line was really opening up creases in a way that Singletary was getting to the second level untouched in scenarios that a lot of backs don't get that opportunity with lesser offensive lines. So the Bills line deserved a lot of credit. And I didn't get a chance to see Singletary in situations where really you could say his ability to beat this angle of a defender or to make this man miss or to be able to earn, you know, huge gains was a product of his burst or his long speed. And the more the season went on, I did get to see some isolated instances where I felt like he showed that his quickness was enough, that he had enough quickness to be able to make the first man miss, and that he did a good job there. I would say overall, the jury's still out for me. And I know that Bills fans are going to be like, oh, you're crazy. But, you know, I don't think the jury's out for me of whether he's enough to be in the NFL. Obviously, he's shown he's got enough to be in the NFL. But when you watch a lot of the plays that he has, a lot of the love that I see for his quickness and how good he is results in 2 and 3 yard gains where he makes multiple people miss, you know, out on the edge, and then he still doesn't turn the corner. So as pretty as some of the runs are, the end result isn't always as strong unless he's, you know, benefiting from a draw play, some screen passes, or a really well-blocked run that opens him a crease where he can do his damage and make the first man miss 3 to 5 yards down the field as opposed to 2 to 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage. So overall, I think that Singletary has proven that he's quick enough, that he has enough burst to be able to access the lanes that he's getting. But I'll be interested to see how he looks when he's facing defenses that keep those creases a little tighter on a more consistent basis, or whether he's dealing with a line that isn't playing as strongly as the Bills line has been playing last year. Because I think he may still be prone to struggling in terms of efficiency of yardage gained between the tackles or outside when the blocking isn't consistently strong. Good player, very instinctive, you know, really great peripheral vision, you know, great footwork. But I think the quickness and speed I'm not changed about it. You know, my mind hasn't changed about his quickness or speed. He's still slower than average. He's not as quick as the average NFL back, but he sees things quicker. And as a result of that, he's able to react quicker. He has good footwork. He's an incredibly intelligent back. And that's one of the things I've talked about him is that he's kind of that outlier that if you say, if it works out for him, he's the extreme case of explaining why that a guy with great vision and average to below average athletic ability, you know, but strong vision and strong footwork can perform adequately to well at the running back position in the NFL. And I think he's making a case for that. So I'm on the positive end with him now, but I still want to see another year, you know, and see more situations out of him because what I've seen enough of with him this year, you know, a lot of the situations kind of repeat themselves. So I didn't see as many of the varieties of scenarios that I would have liked to get a great gauge on Singletary and say definitively, this is where I stand right now. I'd say I'm trending upward, but I'm not completely sold on him. I'm sold on him as an NFL player. I'm sold on him as a contributor. I'm not sold on him as a high end starter, just in a vacuum. Behind this offensive line, you know, he's performing well, and certainly he's shown a lot of promise, and you know, that's awesome. That's absolutely awesome. And you guys are awesome. I appreciate you listening to this podcast. I hope many of you have, you know, a fantastic new year. And that, you know, I know for a lot of people, 2019 was a tough year. Listen, it was a great year for me. You know, my daughter got married. She, you know, she joined the Marines and she's, you know, she's really enjoying what she's doing there. And then, you know, you guys subscribing to the RSP, it's been absolutely fantastic. The feedback that I get from you, every year. And I'm embarking on that mission to create the 2020 RSP. I've been doing that pretty much all summer and all fall anyhow, but now I'm kicking it into higher gear. And, you know, I truly am. I don't get to thank you enough for the opportunity that you've helped give me to, you know, pursue this at the level that I am and get a chance to learn more about the game and share what I've learned with you. So again, you know, if you want to reach out to me, you can email me at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. You can follow my site, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com, as well as the YouTube channel, Matt Waldman's RSP Film Room, where I'm putting out videos almost every day at this rate. I have well over 500 videos out there of prospects that I've scouted over the years, and certainly a fair bit of them already are for this 2020 draft class. You can subscribe to this podcast at any outlet pretty much that you're looking for to download podcast: iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, Spotify, as well as, I believe, Blueberry and Stitcher. So thanks for listening. You guys have a great week. And next week we'll have RSP Quick Game with Mark Schofield.